KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Jeffrey Nunberg's new book has a title that serves as its own promotional announcement. It's called Talking Right: How Conservatives Turned Liberalism into a Tax-Raising, Latte-Drinking, Sushi-Eating, Volvo-Driving, New York Times-Reading, Body-Piercing, Hollywood-Loving, Left-Wing Freak Show. See what I mean? More from Jeff Nunberg on what the left might do to reclaim from the right the language of politics. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When those on the left are accused of being latte-drinking liberals, there's more going on than what author Jeffrey Nunberg calls a seditious taste in beverages. Mr. Nunberg's new book, and get ready now for the full title, is called Talking Right: How Conservatives Turned Liberalism into a Tax-Raising, Latte-Drinking, Sushi-Eating, Volvo-Driving, New York Times-Reading, Body-Piercing, Hollywood-Loving, Left-Wing Freak Show. And while Nunberg acknowledges that the right is much better than the left at political language, he argues there's more going on than just linguistic cleverness. Yes, the Democrats are lousy at bumper stickers, as journalist Joe Klein once put it. But Nunberg's larger concern is with the Democrats' seeming inability to create a real story, a narrative that, when you hear it, makes you want to nod your head in agreement. So how did the right get it right when it comes to language and the left get it wrong? And what storyline might the left now create that would resonate with more Americans? Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also a consulting professor at Stanford University. His previous books include The Way We Talk Now and Going Nuclear. Did I say that with the right presidential inflection?
Exactly, yeah.
Nuclear. Yeah. The president was on our air for the first earlier this morning with his press conference from Chicago, and that seems like an interesting place to start, just in terms of how this president uses language. How would you say that he's effective in the way in which he uses language?
I think he's very effective. You know, when he first ran for national office and then over the course of his first term in particular, he was always getting trashed particularly by people on the left and by Democrats, for his malaprops and his grammatical solecisms and all of the mistakes he made and so on and so forth. And I think that loses sight of the way he uses language. Yeah, it's true he's not the most articulate man we've had in the White House, but he's very good in a sense at communicating a certain perception of who he is, a certain image, if you will, and it's an image that coincides very nicely with the story that the right likes to tell. He says effectively, I mean, he has an artful artlessness, if you want to call it that. He communicates plain words, no nonsense, not too reflective picture of the world that really works very nicely and jibes very nicely with the story that the right has tried to tell about American politics.
You quote David Brooks, the New York Times columnist in your book, as referring to George W. Bush as the sort of person who'd feel right at home in your everyday suburban barbershop. And that's not an unimportant point, right?
I think it's a crucial point. And people do feel that about Bush, particularly a large part of the body of voters who are being contested between the two parties now. It's kind of goofy in a way. I mean, here you have a number of writers on the right saying, well, the elites don't trust George Bush because he's a Republican, because he's a Texan, because when he drank Lone Star beer and not Chardonnay and so on. And this is a theme you hear from Peggy Noonan, from other right-wing reporters. And it's wild because here you have this word elite that's being used of these reporters and academics and critics of Bush, but not of this guy who's the grandson of a senator, the son of a president of the United States, and went to Andover and went to Yale and went to Harvard. By any classical understanding of what it means to be elite, boy, would George W. Bush qualify. And yet the right has been able to take that notion, that word and that notion, and turn it around so that it's used now to apply to these liberal sectors rather than to those who really hold power in America.
Well, that's really central to the premise of your book about how words have taken on a new sense and a new classification, if you will. So let's walk us through, if you would, Jeff Nunberg, about how that happened. How did liberal become a bad word in a way? You talk about the fact that it's now become something that describes in some ways a lifestyle more than necessarily a system of ideals.
I think that's absolutely right. Until 25 or 30 years ago, perhaps, liberal and conservative were understood as competing philosophies of the role of government in economic and social life in particular. And this was a serious philosophical discussion, even if it was tainted by lots of invective on both sides. And at the time of 1960, for example, liberal was not only the dominant, but you could say almost the only philosophical position on government that people took seriously, even if it wasn't clear what it was. And the Wall Street Journal back then is writing editorials that say, gee, how come conservative is a dirty word in politics, even if it's a respectable word when you're talking about dress or an investment strategy? Within 25 years, liberals become the L word, and conservative has become the dominant ideology in American politics. And part of the reason, there are lots of reasons, and some of it has to do with the internal implosion of liberalism and the problems created by Vietnam, the perceived failures of the Great Society, busing and civil rights programs and so on that seemed to ignore the interest of the white working class. But it's also created by a deliberate, I call it a branding campaign, against liberalism and the L word, which managed to turn liberalism from a political philosophy into, as you say and as I suggest in the title, a lifestyle category. It's not about your beliefs about Social Security or taxation or the environment or any of the issues that traditionally separated the two sides. It's about what you drink when you get up in the morning and what you drive to work and what you offer your guests when they come over.
And how did that happen? I mean, in a way, it almost sounds like you're suggesting that there was this very artful and very consistent, almost monolithic ability on the part of those on the right to conduct that kind of branding campaign. I mean, was it that well thought out, that well organized, that consistent a plan?
You know, I don't know if you'd want to call it a conspiracy. But the right has always been very good at coordinating their shtick, so to speak. This dates from the Nixon-Agnew years when this campaign really began, and this notion Middle America suddenly emerged as an important force in politics. It was 1971, I think. I'd have to check it. The Time made Mr. and Mrs. Middle America the people of the year, the persons of the year. So it comes out of that. And the right's ability to stay on message. It comes out of the right's ability to manipulate the media, I would say, and also to create new media formats. This is more in recent times, like AM talk radio, like some of the new cable shows that can reinforce this program, and their ability at spinning this narrative. Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it.
And how important is it that Democrats themselves, and perhaps I'm using the words too equivalently, Democrats, liberals, left, and maybe that's part of the question, that they have different meanings and we're not attributing those correctly. But Democrats also seem afraid of the word liberal.
The attacks on the L word, if I can call it that, began, it's important to remember, on the left. You think of that Phil Oakes song from, was it 1967, I think, Love Me, I'm a Liberal, which made fun of liberals and their hypocrisy and their I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes, it went, but so long as they don't live next door. And the self-satisfied, smug attitude, I think it's fair to say, of a large part of the left of that period, which would applaud when he gave lines like that. It was picked up by the right, who made it a campaign, almost a mantra. It was Reagan in 1988 who introduced this notion of the L word. And it jibed with a certain changing sense of American society where traditional distinctions of class were being replaced by consumer categories, not just in politics, but everywhere. So in the late 1970s, you begin to hear people talking about Volvo liberals and then white wine and brie and latte and all of these products that come to stand in for this stereotype of these self-indulgent Eastern middle class, East Coast and West Coast liberals, that becomes the dominant image of liberals. Now, it has no market reality. If you look at the actual marketing figures, it turns out that the majority of people who buy Brie are Republicans. But that doesn't matter. I mean, it's not surprising. You see a lot more Brie in Marin County than parts of the East Oakland. But nonetheless, Brie has these properties that make it stand in perfectly for your typical liberal. It's pale, it's soft, it's runny, it's French, right? And that's how that works.
Jeffrey Nunberg's new book is called Talking Right. I want to get at the question of why Democrats now are so fearful of that word and whether or not they ought to re-embrace it. But the problem of smugness is also part of this, it seems to me, and would still be true. You said liberals of a certain era were smug, but aren't liberals still to some extent? People still love to make fun of George W. Bush. Well, guess what? He got reelected. I lived in Wisconsin for many years where people loved to make fun of Governor Tommy G. Thompson. Well, guess what? He was elected to four terms. Doesn't that smugness on the part of liberals work against achieving certain goals?
I think so, though, to be sure, we too, I say we because I'm speaking from that side of the table, tend to think of liberals increasingly in accord with a stereotype as being people from the Berkeley Hills. If you're the phrase, for example, working class liberal is virtually inexistent in the American media, left, right, or center. You look in the pages of the New York Times, the Washington Post, on CNN, nobody ever talks about working-class liberals. You might be pro-choice, against the Iraq War, in favor of retaining Social Security in its present form, and so on down the list of liberal issues, liberal positions. But if you don't have granite countertops and you don't drive the right sort of car, even for people on the left, you don't really count as a liberal. So people begin to use this word progressive. I compare it in the book to the strategy that Ford Motor Company undertook when the Edsel became a catastrophe. It was in the 1960s. And so what they did was they took the same car, put a new grill on it, a new trim package, and continued to sell it as the Galaxy, where it sold quite well. And I think the hope that liberals have, well, we'll just call ourselves progressives, and nobody will notice that it's the same people as before.
So what's a liberal to do?
I think, first of all, the L word itself has to be reclaimed, because it isn't about just that word. It's about the stereotypes that are associated with it. And so long as liberals allow the other side to define that term, which is what happened, and themselves distance themselves from it, it moves progressively to the left. They have no control over the notion. The American voters aren't fooled by that. I mean, this liberal-conservative distinction is etched in the American political vocabulary, and for that matter, in the split screens on the cable TV talk shows.
And do you think, Jeff Nunberg, that people would respond to a candidate in the 2008 presidential election who said, I'm a liberal and I'm proud of it?
You know, it may very well be time for that. They certainly didn't respond when John Kerry pussyfooted around the word and refused to use it of himself, nor did they respond when Michael Dukakis in 1988 wouldn't use the word, and then finally said, I guess I'm a liberal, about 2 days before the election, but by then was already marked as somebody who didn't have the courage of his convictions.
So is that part of it, too, that there doesn't seem to be as much authenticity, I guess, on the liberal side, that there's a lack, if you look at Dukakis and Kerry in particular, there's a lack of willingness to say, here's who I am, here's what I think, which is precisely, rightly or wrongly, people do feel about George W. Bush.
I think that's part of it. It's certainly at least been part of the candidates who have, a lot of the candidates who have pussyfooted around this label. It's also the case, though, that liberal itself, the left has allowed the right to define liberalism around these fatuous stereotypes about consumption habits and so on and so forth, rather than in terms of a vision of American politics. And to the extent that Democrats have bailed out on the liberal label, they also are perceived as having no self-image, no self-identity at all. So in polls, 55 to 60% of people say that the Republicans know what they stand for. Barely 30% say that they know the Democrats know what they stand for, because having run from the liberal label, there's no sense of a label at all. As I put it in the book, to most Americans, Republican suggests a movement. Liberal just suggests a zip code. Democrat just suggests a zip code.
And let's talk about two things that seem to that liberals in particular seem to continue to sort of pussyfoot around, which are important: values and patriotism. What should a liberal be saying about values?
Well, those are two very, I think they're two very different words in a certain way. Values is not a word that has historically any importance at all in in American political discourse. It's a word that began its life on the left, like so many of these words do, and then around the end of the 60s was co-opted by Nixon and Agnew in their Southern strategy and made to stand in for a particular set, particular narrative about the way in which these heartland middle Americans had been betrayed in standards of personal morality and patriotism in religion by these fatuous, Volvo-driving East Coast elites. The left has been, Democrats have been trying to retake the word, reclaim the word, since the early 1980s. I mean, in the 1984 campaign, Geraldine Ferraro was talking about American values, family values, up to Kerry's designation of his own campaign as a celebration of American values. It hasn't worked because values doesn't mean simply principles or it doesn't really have its dictionary meaning for these people. It's very frustrating for the left to realize that values, a values issue is something like, should I say Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays? It's not, should we torture prisoners? That's not a matter of values as the word is used in American politics. But for just that reason, it isn't about recapturing that word. It's about telling a narrative that counterbalances the narrative that the right has told.
So does that mean that Democrats or liberals worry too much about saying, I have values too, I have values too, and instead really ought to be saying, here are the values that I stand for, whatever those
have. Here are the values, and moreover, here's the story I tell. Here's the narrative I tell in terms of which my values are made clear. But Clinton was brilliant at this, in the 92 election in particular. I'm tired of seeing people who play hard, work hard and play by the rules get the shaft. That's like a little movie capsule summary from the television movie.
And what's striking to me when I read that sentence in your book is that you sort of nod your head when you hear that. You get it right away, what that person's about. And it doesn't seem to me, I heard a comic say the other day about John Kerry that, you know, you needed a trail of breadcrumbs to follow his sort of course of thinking back to where he started at the beginning of an answer to a question. That wasn't true with Clinton. And so is that why narrative matters, why story matters? You need to have a beginning, middle, and end. You need to make a point.
Right. And these words, like values, like elite, like liberal and conservative themselves, it isn't as if they have meanings that come out of the dictionary. Their meanings are fixed by these narratives. And the right has been very skillful at telling these. In fact, the mark of the right's success in putting its narrative over isn't in the success, say, of Reagan, the great communicator, who could have told any story persuasively, just given his skills. It's in the fact that people like Bill Frist and Sam Brownback, people who have zero charisma, can nonetheless tell this story and get away with it.
Well, play that role for a moment, if you would, Jeff Nunberg. Tell us the Republican narrative.
Well, the Republican narrative is a very familiar one. It is, as I say, about this. First of all, this invention of middle America, as opposed to these areas on the coast. Blue and red is the way it's put now, and that's an invention of the right, that have this division that has riven the country into two separate nations, as different commentators like to say, and you hear this from people on the left too, as the two sides during the Civil War, or as the two nations of Disraeli's England, the rich and the poor. That's nonsense. That's just goofy. America is more homogeneous culturally in terms of consumer habits and in terms of political attitudes than at any time in recent history. There's a perception of this deep polarization, but if you look at, and this is from people on both the left and the right who have looked at this, if you look at surveys, if you look at polls, if you ask what Americans believe, they are in fact closer on most of the major issues than they were a generation or two ago.
So the first part of the conservative narrative, as you describe it, is that it's important to make that division?
To make that division between red and blue, which is a specious division.
And so when George W. Bush says, as you quote him in the book, saying, I'm so glad to be back in the American heartland where I know what true values are, that's a statement of division in a sense, and identity?
Oh, yeah. The heartland, middle Americans, all of those phrases, which began again with Nixon and the Southern strategy, are an invention of the right. Not that there aren't cultural differences and differences in consumption, but less than ever before. I mean, I tell a story in this book about one way of making this point is that I went up to Infineon Raceway up here in Sonoma with my daughter, and we're standing outside the pit area drinking with the other people a nice Sonoma Zinfandel, hoping for a glimpse of Jeff Gordon or Richard Petty.
NASCAR drivers.
NASCAR drivers. And it's as if the narrative suggests that, well, if you don't believe in Social Security privatization, you're somehow not going to be able to get a thrill out of watching 40 750 horsepower cars come roaring by at 150 miles an hour. There is no connection at all.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at both the University of California, Berkeley, and Stanford University. His new book is called Talking Right. Well, on NASCAR, there was sort of an urban myth. I don't think he actually said it, but the mythology was that at one point John Kerry said during the 2004 campaign, "Who among us does not like NASCAR?" Now, whether or not he actually said it, it was quite believable that he would say such a thing. And that in itself didn't identify him with that heartland.
It certainly says something about, whether it says something about Kerry or not, about the perception that people had of Kerry, that they were willing to believe he would say such a thing. I mean, as I made it the point at the time, and I bought into it, I have to say, before I learned that he hadn't said it. You don't say, "Who among us does not like NASCAR?" You say, "Who among us does not like Rigoletto?" Right?
That's right, that's where you're right.
But so I had fallen for it as well. And again, it's this idea. I mean, my sense, for instance, is that the book on Kerry's patriotism, that Kerry was somehow not patriotic and so on, had far less to do with the charges by the Swift Boat veterans or his activities after Vietnam than it did with the fact that the man speaks French. Right? How can somebody who speaks French that well be a patriot?
But that's a really interesting point, because in the end, that the consequence of that is that how language is used matters more than what someone actually did.
Well, I don't know if you can say that. I don't want to be thought of as one of these people who says, "Oh, it's just a question of spinning the right line of pattern. That's how the Republicans have done it. We have to spin a better line of pattern to do that." It's not simply a question of language. It's a question of having a set of programs that appeal to the broad interest of American middle class and working class voters. But that said, if you have a successful collection of programs, if you can't wrap that story in an overarching narrative that gives meanings to the words you use, then you're going to have trouble putting it over. It's the difference between having a bad story. I tell the story about Oldsmobile, the way General Motors tried to save the Oldsmobile line.
Not your father's.
Your father's Oldsmobile. And people looked at it and they said, that's my father's Oldsmobile.
Yeah, right? We have to take a break in just a moment, Jeff Nunberg, but give us the bare bones, just the hint of what you think that Democratic narrative ought to be.
I think it is a populist narrative, like, in a certain sense, the Republican narrative, but one which restores, rather than thinking of notions like elite and middle America and so on, in terms of these vague and as I say, specious cultural distinctions, that restores their economic basis and the difference between the haves and, if not the have-nots, the people who work hard and play by the rules, as Clinton said.
More like John Edwards' Two Americas, that sort of story, which you can sort of get in an instant.
Right. Edwards has an instinctive gift for this kind of talk and for this narrative. And the trick is to take the kind of narrative he takes and make it one that any Democrat can take. You don't have to have his gifts to be able to put over.
Jeff Nunberg is our guest. His new book is called Talking Right, and here's the whole title, Talking Right: How the Right Turned Liberalism into a Tax-Raising, Latte-Drinking, Sushi-Eating, Volvo-Driving, New York Times-Reading, Body-Piercing, Hollywood-Loving, Left-Wing Freak Show. And when we come back, if you have thoughts on how those words ought to change and what the Democratic narrative storyline ought to be, you can give us a call. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. And welcome back to Forum. Our guest this hour, Jeff Nunberg, teaches at both the University of California, Berkeley, and at Stanford. His new book, Talking Right: How Conservatives Turn Liberalism into a Tax-Raising, Latte-Drinking, Sushi-Eating, Volvo-Driving, and I'll just leave it at that, freak show. And we welcome your calls at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your questions at forum@kqed.org. A first question from Tom in Berkeley, Jeff Nunberg, who said, if you were hired as a consultant to the Democrats, what would you tell them?
Well, pretty much what I've been saying here. I have talked to the Democratic Senate caucus a couple of years ago, and I think it's a question of finding a story and sticking to it. I mean, the other thing that the Republicans are awfully good at is telling the same story over and over and over again.
And you, in fact, did sort of a breakout. I can't remember which year's convention it was, of the convention speeches, and how it was easy to take all of the speeches made at the Republican convention and come up with a paragraph that summed them up. Impossible to do with the speeches at the Democratic convention.
Right. I actually took in one of those automatic summarization programs that I was actually working on with some other people and ran them, took all the speeches from the 1996 Republican convention the first 2 days, put them in one big file, ran the summarizer over them, and it came back with this perfect summary of the ideal Republican stump speech. We are the Republican Party, a big, broad, diverse, and inclusive party with a common sense agenda. We need a leader we can trust. The quest in helping to restore the American dream. All these phrases just kept rising to the surface. A month later, I did the same thing with the speeches from the first 2 days of the Democratic convention. And it returned word salad, completely current word salad. That's because Democrats can't stay on message. One of them goes off in this direction. One goes off in the other direction. You think of what Will Rogers said, I don't belong to any organized party. I'm a Democrat.
But to some extent, then, isn't that the nature of the beast, that part of being a liberal is being open to a lot of possibilities, perhaps? And so that sort of message discipline is, in fact, almost oxymoronic to being a liberal.
It's certainly partly that. As Ron Brownstein of the LA Times has said, it's also the case that when you're out of power, you don't really have an interest in getting onto the same page. It's only when there's actual pies to be divided that people start to do that. So it is very in part a question of staying on message, but it's also part of a question of not getting distracted by these bumper sticker wars. Because it turns out that for all that liberals are indignant over these phrases like clear skies and healthy forest and no child left behind and so on, they don't actually affect public opinion as much as people think. People still give Democrats the edge on the environment and education and taxes. It's really this ground-level language of politics that's important.
Well, and we saw that also with the great Social Security debate of the past year, right? So that even though people may be rejecting the word liberal and associate it with latte and sushi and all the rest, the great programs that came out of that philosophy are still actually embraced by many Americans.
Absolutely. And there was a linguistic point there as well, because at a certain point, the Republicans looked at their polling data and saw that the phrase privatization or the word privatization of private accounts weren't polling well. And they said, no, they're personal accounts. And in fact, if you look at the press, most of the press went along with that. The proportion of stories describing them as personal rather than private accounts doubled over about 2 or 3 months after the Republicans started making that point. Did it, however, affect views on the, I'm going to call them the privatization proposals? No, it didn't. It had almost no effect at all. So we tend perhaps to over-exaggerate the effect of these catchphrases and labels and so on and underestimate the importance of this ground-level language.
And to our calls, Neil in San Francisco starts us out. Neil, go ahead.
Yeah, a comment and a question. First of all, the so-called heartland, middle America, or the red America, which we hear about, and your Professor Nuremberg appears to be somewhat skeptical of, isn't that just a really continuation of the old Bible Belt that Macon played with and a lot of writers for many years loved to look down upon and I think was a valid thing? And it really, what you have here is the decline of two big factors that were supporters of the Democratic Party, liberal or not, and that was the South, which, as Lyndon Johnson said, we lost when he signed the Civil Rights Bill, and the decline of labor, big labor, industrial labor. So those are two things that are somewhat independent of labeling, I think. Now, as far as labeling goes, I do a couple of points on that.
Just one, please, Neil.
Yeah,
and
okay.
Then we'll
whatever happened to the we used to have liberal and radical, and we had conservative and reactionary. And I thought reactionary was a great term to use for a lot of the kind of people who really are reactionary.
All right. Thanks, Neil.
Let me just take up the first part of that. It's certainly true that there's this traditional notion of the Bible Belt and that is culturally very much a distinctive part of America. The middle American strategy was rather different. It was to take those traditionalist, fundamentalist parts of largely of the South and blend them together with other parts of American culture, businessmen, people in the Plain States, retirees in Arizona, people in Southern California. The red states, that notion of culture, is something far wider than the Bible Belt. And in fact, the object of this is to create, I would say, an illusion of cultural homogeneity among a number of parts of the country that really don't have a lot in common, and in so doing, efface, among other things, the very important differences in economic interests that the upper middle class people have from the working class Americans.
So can, I mean, the last coastal Democrat to win the presidency was John F. Kennedy, right? Since then, it's Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, all from the South. Is that a requirement now, that you have to establish your sort of bona fides as being part of the middle?
You know, I don't know. Certainly that seems to be part of the received wisdom among the Democratic Party. On the other hand, the Democrats haven't run an Eastern candidate like Kennedy since then. Had Cuomo, for example, run for the presidency, which could very easily have happened, I think he would have been enormously successful at articulating this middle American this generally American view of things.
Tell the story, if you would, Jeff Nunberg, about the difference between how Mario Cuomo once responded to a question about the death penalty compared to how Michael Dukakis famously sort of botched it when he ran for the presidency in 1988. Because one was the answers weren't so much different in their conclusions about their feelings about the death penalty, but there was a huge amount of difference in the degree of passion.
Exactly. Dukakis was asked famously during the 1988 presidential debate, I think the first debate, whether he would favor the death penalty for a man who had raped and murdered his wife. And Dukakis answered, and I have the answer here actually, no, I don't, and I think you know that I'm opposed to the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. Not dealing with the personal basis of the question at all. Asked a similar question a couple of years later, Mario Cuomo said he opposed the death penalty because it's wrong, because it's dumb, because it's counterproductive, because it's an introduction to violence, instruction in violence, because it won't make my daughter safe. She then told a story about his daughter being touched by the same man, and we never caught him. Sam Donaldson asked him what he would have done if he'd caught the man, and Donaldson answered, he probably would have committed a terrible sin. When Donaldson pressed him, he said, would you have killed him? Cuomo answered, I don't know, Sam, and I don't want to know, but the point is, God forbid that I should make laws that are only as good as me. With a very power, connecting it to his religious faith, a powerful personal response that people could respond to, and I think defending exactly the position that Dukakis was making in terms that ordinary Americans could react to.
And to Rob in Pleasanton. Rob, go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to make a couple comments about your guest. When he talks about the story and he's talking about going to NASCAR with his daughter and sitting in the pit and drinking wine and all that, he talks about the cars rumbling down at 150 miles an hour. That tells me volumes because, just a quick point, the cars rumble down at about 189 miles an hour. And as a conservative, that gives me a clue that your guest really went there to gawk at conservatives the same way you would gawk at zoo animals at the zoo. He really doesn't get it when it comes to what we really stand for. And he really just went there to take in the sight, so to speak. And,
all right. Let's get a response, Rob. Interesting question.
I like NASCAR. I love country music. The curve I would stand, as you surely know, how fast the cars are rumbling by depends on what track you're at and what curve you're standing at. The point is that whether one likes country music or NASCAR or doesn't has nothing to do with whether one favors a reform of Social Security or privatization of Social Security, nor the other way. Rod Dreher, who writes for National Review, is a conservative columnist at in Dallas, has written about crunchy cons, he called them, crunchy conservatives, and says the same thing from the other point of view. Why should being a conservative require me to enjoy shopping at Walmart or drinking bad coffee or so on, or avoiding organic food? What do these cultural and consumer decisions have to do with the important philosophical decisions that once upon a time were the reason for these, were what lay behind these debates?
Go ahead, Rob.
I would just follow up and say, how many times have you gone in the last 3 years? But regardless, I would follow up by saying the title of your book, I think you get it. I think you have it just right, because I work in a liberal company. I live in a liberal community as a conservative, and they do all drive Volvos, and they drink lattes, and they eat sushi, and they're and they hate George Bush. And I think they're just completely out of touch. So when you talk about red and blue, and you look at that county map of the United States after the election, and you look at that sea of red, and then you look at those patches of blue, I think you've got it just right, and I'll take my comment off the air.
Rob, thanks for calling.
Yeah, if you look, I mean, there are 2 points here. First of all, it turns out that the difference between Democrats and Republicans who buy Volvo is about 2% now. There's almost no difference between those. It turns out that Republicans, as I say, buy more Brie than Democrats do and so on. These consumer stereotypes, among other things, are just false. NASCAR realizes that very well because they do very well in markets like Northern California, Philadelphia, and so on, in the heart of blue states. What's more, those election maps that you talk about where you see the sea of blue and the sea of red work very nicely at the state level, less well at the county level. And when you actually break it down by votes, shading it from a bright crimson to deep purple, the country looks a lot less divided geographically than it does on those other maps. The fact is that Americans, and in consumer habits, in political attitudes, in cultural attitudes, are far more heterogeneous on the one hand than these stereotypes suggest.
E.J. Dionne, in his book, Why Americans Hate Politics, many years ago, made the point that there really is one of the reasons why Americans hate politics is that there's this push by politicians to polarize us, to divide us, and that there really is a vast middle. Is that part, then, of what Democrats ought to do, is reclaim the middle and say that's ours, too?
Absolutely. I cite in this book a number of studies, some by Alan Wolf, the liberal sociologist at Brandeis, some by Morris Fiorina, who's at Stanford, and the Hoover Institution, both of whom agree, although there's disagreement on details, that the notion of the culture wars is just a fiction. It's a fiction if you look at American attitudes on the issues you find more uniformity about the basic issues than anybody could suggest. The polarization, if I may, the polarization is a phenomenon. It's true of Congress. It's true of the media in the sense that as people at Fox News learned and other cable stations have aped them in this, that's what sells apples. But it isn't true of ordinary American attitudes.
Jeff Nunberg is our guest. His new book is called Talking Right. He teaches at both the University of California, Berkeley, and at Stanford University. I want to follow up, though, on Rob's central observation, though, which was that he's saying, you know, all those things you list in your title, from latte drinking to Volvo driving, have, for him at least, a certain ring of truth. And there is the argument. The argument can be made. It's not just that liberals are misunderstood, as you say in your book. It also can sometimes be argued that they're understood too well, that there is some falling into not necessarily buying a Volvo, but that sort of liberal smugness and looking askance at anything that would fall east of the Berkeley Hills.
Well, or west of 10th Avenue, West End Avenue in New York. That's surely true about those communities. There's a kind of particular kind of liberal smugness that you see in these islands like my part of San Francisco or the Berkeley Hills, just as there's a kind of political smugness among a certain type of conservative. You think of these bow-tied Ivy Leaguers at the National Review who are sitting there typing screeds typing tributes to Merle Haggard and Walmart, for example. So every movement that's compelling enough to have its followers is also going to have its poseurs and pretentious people. Now, Orwell made the same point about the socialist in the 1930s. That said, I think this idea that liberal and conservative are two different nations, two different races, two different political genders, divided by this vast difference in taste and sensibility, simply isn't true. It isn't true about the consumer behavior, not just as people in Northern California enjoy NASCAR and why that NASCAR organization knows that. People in Oklahoma buy Godiva chocolates and go to Restoration Hardware and do all of the things that only liberals are supposed to do. Starbucks didn't become the company it did by merely opening stores in blue states.
There's no liberal latte offered at Starbucks. Let's go next to Debbie in San Jose. Debbie, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Well, I'd just like to comment about what's happening with the Democratic Party. I'm a lifelong Democrat. I've off and on changed over to other parties because of, you know, frustration, but I want to come back and I want to say that I think we need to become a fight fire with fire party. We need to become some pit bull Democrats, some big dog, bad dog Democrats, not ready to play nice anymore, in the style of the old Chicago and the Kansas City Democrats. hard-nosed, no-holds-barred, no more nice guys. I think it's time we need to return every single silly thing that they send our way based on, you know, demographics right back at them. And I think when they run these negative ads that are not true, we need to respond immediately, item by item. The technology today is there. We don't utilize it. The Republicans utilize all this stuff, and we don't utilize it. And I want to say one thing to Rob, the conservative who called in. The Republicans are a party and a people driven by fear. They're afraid of anything unknown. They're afraid of people that don't look like them, that don't worship like them, that don't do things like them. They are a party driven by fear.
All right. Thank you, Debbie. Although I think you could also, say the Democrats are sometimes afraid of people who aren't like them and don't have quite the same liberal taste that they do. But to Debbie's central point, Jeff Nunberg, on fighting fire with fire.
I think there are two ways of understanding that, and that Debbie's right about one of them is a sort of tactical approach. What do you do when the swift boat charges are made, or what do you do when what you consider an outrageous charge is made, or when a phrase like cut and run suddenly becomes you suddenly see that on the lips of every Republican? Do you respond aggressively and so on? Tactically, yes, I think that's an important thing to do as a general political principle. But I think more than that and beyond that, I come back to this question of having a narrative that speaks to the emotions and the indignation and the sense of dissatisfaction that the Republicans have been so successful in mining, that Clinton was brilliant doing in the 1992 campaign.
Well, part of, you know, I remember the last time I saw Clinton give a big speech. It might have been in the 2004 convention. But you have this sense when you watch him give a speech that he's building to something. He'll even pause partway through and say, and so, it's like he's taking you somewhere and you want to kind of follow along. It doesn't seem like there are many others who have that sort of rhetorical skill, because that's all about storytelling.
It is indeed. And as I say, Clinton and Edwards are very gifted at it in the same way that Reagan and some other Republicans have been gifted at it. But the important thing is not the teller, but the story, because as I say, the Republican success isn't connected simply to having a couple of great storytellers like Reagan, but to having this story about the decent folks in the heartland and the supercilious snobs on the coast and so on. That's a story that anybody can tell. Anybody can call into a TV talk station, any talk host, AM talk host from Rush Limbaugh down to some guy who's just trying to make a name for himself at a small station in the South, can quickly pick up the language and the story and the tone, work the indignation that the right has been very successful in working, and make this a successful form of communication. That's what the Democrats have to be able to do.
You say in your book, Jeff Nunberg, that it's also not just a question of getting the lyrics right. You have to write the tune. What do you mean by that? Is that in a sense like the old line, you got to be able to dance to it?
Yeah. Look, think of that. Again, I keep coming back to that Clinton line, but I think it stands in very well for the way this works. What's a narrative? A narrative's got characters and a plot. People work hard and play by the rules. There's your characters. They get the shaft. That's the plot. And the way Clinton put that, using the phrase, they get the shaft, which spoke to the sensation that ordinary Americans have about their experience, that's the tune. You saying exactly the same thing in abstract language or language that sounds like it came out of some copywriter's computer is not going to have the same effect.
Jeff Nunberg is our guest. His book is Talking Right. We welcome your calls at 866-733-6786, and you can email us at forum@kqed.org. To James in Richmond. James, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just liking to comment that I think saying that the problem with the Democrats' incoherent narrative isn't a tactical problem, it's a strategic problem, in that, you know, they can respond to negative ads or whatever just as well as anyone else, but the content of their narrative is off, it's tone deaf. And the reason I believe that is because the Republican ideals and narrative is much closer to the reality of today with the globalization and the network and the towards individualism. And I think that the Democrats are talking about wars that they already won. They're talking about race. They're talking about gender equality. They're talking about stuff. but they've already won those. They're done. And their forward-looking stuff is all, you know, collective solutions from the 30s, socialism, you know, nationalized medicine, all this stuff. And it's just wrong. It's not going to work in today's society. And I'd just like to take my answer off there. Thank you.
James, thank you.
Yeah, I think it's a very good question, James. I would disagree with you either that the issues of gender and race and certainly sexual orientation have been won, or that those aren't still important battles to fight. I think what you do get at, there are two important things you get at. First of all, you remark that the Democrats are tone deaf. And let me just say that the first sentence of my book is the question, are the Democrats simply tone deaf? Yes, that's right. And in particular, and I think this is what you're getting at, the Democrats haven't been able to adapt the traditional populist rhetoric of the New Deal era or of Truman to a society in which the crucial part of the electorate, and this is thanks to the New Deal, is largely middle class. But at the same time, I think it's important to realize, and I think you said this too, that the anxieties that the middle class now feels, and these are about health care, about retirement, about the stability of their pensions, are anxieties that bring them in a certain sense closer to the interests of working class Americans now than at any time in the last 30 or 40 years.
And you also point out in your book that Democrats haven't done very well with grappling with sort of the real gut issues that a lot of people have to contend with, whether that's teen issues or crime or illegitimacy. You write, quote, they're oddly diffident about the moral threats to family life. What's that about?
Well, I think that's part of this same story, absolutely, the Democrats are good at responding with programs and bullet points to these, and their programs are likely more effective than the Republican programs. What they don't speak to is the sense that there are moral questions in American life. There's a kind of indignation about, say, an issue like teen pregnancy or pornography or so on that Democrats have, for some odd reason, diffident about being indignant about these things. And there's a deterioration in many aspects of public life that the Republicans have recognized as an important question, and Democrats haven't been able to speak to that with any persuasive fervor. Again, Clinton was the exception. He could articulate that sense not simply of here's what we have to do practically, but this is upsetting, and Americans should be upset about this.
So what does that mean for future Democratic Party candidates, be they at the local level or at the national level? Bill Clinton is not going to be cloned, but is it important to have that quality as much as any other, that you have the ability, whether it's what Mario Cuomo or John Edwards or Bill Clinton all had, great orators, but in the end, people who connect? What is that quality that's so important?
I think there are two parts to it. One is, as I suggest, with Clinton and Cuomo, the ability to tell these stories with passion and to not be afraid of one's own passion or afraid of appealing to the emotions. That's the important work, the symbolic work that political politics does for us. And on the other hand, it's to have this story. It's to restore this traditional populist narrative, but not in the terms, as I say, of the New Deal, but one that recognizes the commonality of interest of the working class and the working middle class.
David writes in and cites another person who we should probably add to our list of people who do have this ability. He writes, Barack Obama has been regularly releasing podcasts. His speech in 2004 was clearly no fluke. He's a powerful orator and a wonderfully clear thinker. Do you think that one powerful voice and personality could provide Democrats with a unique and recognizable discourse?
Well, look, I don't know. It's hard to say at this point what Obama's future is. It's clearly, at this point, looks like a very bright one. But I think more important, the response that he's engendered shows the hunger, not just from the Democratic base, but from a huge number of Americans who are concerned about these issues, whose reflexive positions on the issues are much closer to those of the Democrats than to the Republicans, but who do not hear coming from the Democrats the kind of passionate voice or passionate story that gives them a sense that there's something here more than a list of bullet items, which is what the Democrats up to now have been providing.
And to another caller, Yara in Santa Cruz. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask Professor Nunberg about George Lakoff's books. George Lakoff is a professor also at Berkeley, and his book Moral Politics and his all ideas about framing and all those kinds of things seem to be fairly in line with the things that you talk about. And I'm wondering, A, if you've had a chance or, you know, what do you think about his work? And also, given the things that both of you talk about, how do we go about using these ideas, these tools for democratic success as opposed to just, you know, publishing great books about it?
All right. Thanks for the call.
I know George's work. We're colleagues and have known each other for a long time. I think there are parts of that work that are very important. The emphasis on framing and the words one uses has certainly woken up the Democrats more than anyone else to the importance of language. I think if I have problems with it, it's more in the way it's been taken, I think, than in most of the things George says. On the one hand, it's encouraged this distraction. Well, we have to find language that works as well as death tax or clear skies does, and encourage people to think in terms of these catchphrases and issue framing rather than what I think of, as I say, as the ground-level language of politics. There's also a sense in which George's most recent book, Don't Think of an Elephant, encourages this idea, a kind of left-wing version of this right-wing idea that liberal and conservative are not simply different philosophical positions on government, but reflect deep underlying theories of the family and that become eternal types. And I think that supports, unwittingly at least, this two Americas view of things that does the work of the right for it.
And we have to leave it there. Jeff Nunberg, author of Talking Right, thanks very much for being part of our program today. Really a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer this past hour has been Paul Ancour, and the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson. Monday morning on Forum, Michael will take up the topic of the caliber and quality of our oceans. That'll be his topic in the 9 o'clock hour. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.